We'll just give the latecomers another couple of minutes. We're on time. Well, I see no reason for not starting already. My name is Alex, and I welcome all of you to the test traffic working group. And I wanted to go through the usual beginning item for these kinds of meetings, to kindly ask somebody to take notes. Not that they were read or solicited, judging by the traffic on the mailing list, but I think it's a nice thing to make a written summary of what has been discussed. I know that Mark was a very kind volunteer last time. You're going to volunteer again, Mark? Okay, thank you very much. And do we have a co-scribe, somebody else? This is? Oh, Ruben, yes, of course. So thank you very much, Ruben and Mark. As I said, I got the feeling based on the traffic on the list that not very many people, the list has not really been very active. But just on the outside chance that some of you have written the notes from the last time, is there anybody who has questions or issues, or they want to wrap up things that they feel have not had closure? Any questions on the previous minutes? Or how about, has anybody read the previous minutes? Please raise your hands. Who? Very good. And I read them too, so that makes three of us. So that's, Ruben, excellent. Okay, that's it's almost 10% maybe. Okay, very good. So now we have a scribe, and I realize that I cannot make people come up to the microphone with their ideas and, you know, try to share things in public. And I hope that you can feel comfortable enough to approach me, or Hank, or other members of the project, with things that you feel are near and dear to your heart, things that you want to do. It would be that much more useful if you find the courage in yourself to go to the microphone and either make a comment or a suggestion. Remember that ultimately what this particular group is about is trying to provide a service that will soon be public in terms of data to the network operator community. So you are going to get out of it about as much as you put in it. There are many things that can be done, but without operator input and support, that is, without paying membership support for these kinds of things, you're not going to see much happening. And there are other people, such as the research community, of which I'm a part, that would benefit from it, but that's not really fair. And frankly, I often feel guilty, because you guys, the paying members, are not getting the benefit. So, enough said about this. I will not belabor the point. Please feel free to contribute as much as you can. And I hope sincerely that the choices that we have made in speakers today and for tomorrow at the 11 o'clock session are going to be to your liking. They define them that are useful and to the point in the context of this particular working group. And I would very much like to hear if you think otherwise, or if you have ideas that you think are good for the next meeting, or what it is that you'd like to see. Again, don't be shy. So without any further delay, I want to introduce our first presenter. And I want to say that we have been very fortunate in getting a number of people who have exploited the wealth of data that is provided by TTM, and who also happens to be, you know, working in the research community in Holland. And we have Jan Pascal van Best from Technical University Delft, where he is. Pardon, forgive me. The first thing that I was supposed to do is backspace a little bit, is to give the microphone to my co-chair, Hank, who watches over the TTM project at the NCC. So let me do that first. Forgive me, Hank.
Good afternoon, everybody. There we go. Let me just switch presentations here. There we go. So most of you will know by now I'm Hank Adler from Drive at CC, and I'm doing the usual status update of the TTM service on behalf of the whole list of people working on the project at the NCC. So, what I want to cover this afternoon, I have a few general remarks, have a few slides on testbox installation. We have added some features to the service and analyzed some data. I want to share the most important results with you. Then I have one slide on IETF developments. As some of you may know, I'm also the co-chair of the IPPM working group at the IETF, and there's one issue that came up here which is probably relevant to this group, and I end up with the plans we have for the coming months. So we have one staff change. Careful readers of the first slide had already noticed it, but in case you don't, Maximo Alves, who was with us for a little over 2 years as a network engineer, has left the NCC and has gone back to Brazil. Then I have one slide about invoices. The finance department asked me to put that in. If you host a test box, you get invoices for service fees. If you have a question on those, send them to the finance department. Their address is billing@ripe.net. Please don't send those queries to any other address you have for TTM. That will only delay things. For the EU sites, we get a lot of questions about this. That's about the VAT. And the message is very simple. If we do not have your EU VAT number on our files, we have to charge you VAT. That's something that tax authorities make us do, and it happens even if you're VAT exempt. We cannot just say yes, this site is VAT exempt, but we don't have a VAT number, so we didn't charge us. Tax authorities won't like that. Of course, if you get an invoice with VAT and you think it should be VAT free, just send us the number and we'll be happy to provide you with a new invoice. So, let's move on to the more interesting stuff. We have updated some of our documents. There was a document called RIPE 241. I know, 214. That describes the conditions of sale for the test box. That document was about 3 or 4 years old, and it was hopelessly outdated. It specified what a test box was and said, for example, that we were selling Pentium 1 processors. Now, if you ever try to buy a Pentium 1 processor, you know that's impossible. But still, we used this document when selling things. Unfortunately, nobody protested. But this document just had to be revised, so we made a handful of small changes in the text, mainly to make it up to date with present technologies. And of course, this is something that only applies to the test boxes we sell after this date. The second thing we did was replace the data disclosure policy, or the AUP. I sent a draft to the mailing list. I believe it was just late November or early December. I did not receive any comments either by either on the list or the private mail. So we went up and finished it. The document was published January 23rd, which is last Friday, and it will. I'm not sure if it's already on the FTP site, but otherwise it will be in a day or two. So what did we change there? Well, we make the acceptable use policy a lot more lightweight. It basically now says that the data is open, it can be used for any study. However, there's some protection to avoid abuse. Main thing is that if you look at the data and you want to publish something about it, the publication has to be peer-reviewed, and that can be done by, for example, coming to this working group and give a presentation, or send a paper to the mailing list, or give us a copy of the paper and ask us to put it on the websites, whatever. Once it's published, there will be a call for comments, 2 weeks, and any comments that we receive or that the authors are brought up on the list will be discussed with the authors, and if necessary, an next iteration of the paper will be done. The NCC will continue to control distribution of the data. Papers, if you publish the data, it should include a reference to the source of the data, and we'll make sure that there is an archive for published papers. So, actually, I see that something is wrong in the slide. It says 298, but the number is really around 300. Fix that. There's some consequences. We'll remove some of the access restrictions to the test traffic site, making things accessible since, yeah, it's open. Why put a password on to protect something that doesn't need protection? We will, however, make sure that everybody is made fully aware of the AUP the first time he or she accesses one of the TDM page. We also put disclaimers on the various spots that we produce, pointing people explicitly to the AUP. And all this will happen soon after this meeting, where as soon as we have a chance to fiddle around with our websites. What we're not going to open up is access to more recent data and all the data you have on the website on your local test box. Those boxes are really for monitoring purposes in your NOC. They're not intended to be a public web server, so they're not going to be a public web server. In principle, the following morning. That's it, by the way. Yes. Exactly. Related to that, we said in the activity plan that if we could remove those these restrictions, we would lower the service fee, and effective January 1st, we have done that, so fees have dropped by about a factor of 3. You'll see that on your next invoice. Also, we're about to order the next batch of hardware, and thanks to a high euro or a low dollar, prices have dropped, and the next batch of test boxes will also be a bit cheaper. And that brings me to the number of new test boxes installed since the last meeting, or actually since beginning of 2001. The last two peaks are Q3 and Q4 of last year, and in that time we installed 17 new test boxes. We also announced that we would upgrade the kernels on the so-called Series D, Series C and Series D boxes. We're still in the process of doing that. We have a bit of problem reaching contact for about 5 sites. We were trying to locate them. I didn't see anybody from those sites here this week, which is a bit unfortunate, but it will happen in due course. Okay. So, analysis that we did on the data. It's a whole list, and I'll just go through it. The first thing is sort of the conclusion of a project we have been ongoing. It had been ongoing for a while, mapping IP addresses to origin ASs. At RIPE 46, René presented a study on that. He looked at the Internet Routing Registries where IP and ASs are entered by hand, and he looked at the RIS routing tables, and basically he showed that in about 1 out of 5 cases, the IRRs are wrong with respect to what you see on the internet. So we turned that into a tool for the TTM data, where you can also find ASs belonging to IP traces. We started to use that on November 10th. We had some requests from the community to make this a public tool. We did that. Main features are that the public version uses the Whois protocol, it uses RPSL as the output format, and that makes it easy to use in all kinds of existing tools. It supports both IPv4 and IPv6, and just to give you an example, this is my workstation on my desk at the NCC office, and suppose I didn't know in which AS I was, I type in who I is minus this host for the address 193.0.1.49, and then it returns the stuff in blue. It says that it belongs to /21.193.0.0, and I'm in AS 3333, which is the RIPE NCC. Well, I knew that before, but just to show you what it can do. So what we plan to do here is, this thing was announced on December 5th. We have received a few comments from various people by mail for a few small extra features and enhancements. That will be done shortly after this meeting, and then we consider this project finished and available as a tool for anybody who has an application where you want to map IPs to ASs. No. No, not in this tool, but I mean, you can actually download RIS data and look at it. Yes. Yeah. Okay, next thing is IPv6 tunnel detection. As you probably know, IPv6 traffic is frequently routing over frequently tunneled over IPv4 paths, where you pack an IPv6 packet inside an IPv4 packet. As a consequence, the MTU of the IPv6 packets will be smaller, and by measuring the MTU, you can find tunnels in your V6 path. Technical details were explained yesterday afternoon in Lorenz's talk in the V6 working group. We put a wrapper around this tool and run it on the test boxes, and it's available from the V6 database page. And if you go there, you'll get a matrix which looks like this. On the left-hand side, you have the source test boxes. On the top, you have all the possible destinations. And color-coded, you find the MTU. And whatever appears like green on my screen and like dark yellow on the screen over there is 1500, which is native IP. If it's yellow, the MTU is lower, and we suspect a tunnel there. And you can also have orange, and then we don't have data. And you can click. You have buttons to select specific subsets of test boxes if you like to do that. And you can also click on one of the numbers, and it links you to a trace route. And if you would do that, you get something like this, which is a V6 trace route between box 56 and whatever the target was. The V6 addresses and the MTU in the last column. So the first hop was native. And now, okay. Then the tunnel started with MTU 1476. That went on for three hops, and then the next tunnel starts with an MTU of 1280. Yeah, that's it. You can also scroll to the right, and then you see the same data for the return paths. So the next thing we added was support for multiple MIGs. This is something that came up here in this working group a long time ago when we finally finished it. There are all kinds of applications where you want to run two NICs and two IP addresses on a single box. For example, you have two upstreams. You have internal and external networks which are really separated. You're an IX. And you want to share a test box with a few people there. So we added support for a second NIC. That makes it essentially virtual second or third test box inside your existing test box with the data splits. And just to show you an example how you can use it, suppose your provider, you have two upstreams, A and B, each with their own gateway, and somehow connected to the internet. No, you actually have two physical networks. Okay, so you have two test boxes, and you have two gateways from your upstreams, and A is the default path, and B only have for backup purposes. So if you have one NIC and just route it and don't do anything special, this is what you'll see: test box, gateway over the internet to another test box, and you get a nice plot. Standard plots. However, even though the other path is a backup, you often, and only used if something is wrong with the first path, you often want to monitor that this path is working as it should, so that if something is happening with your first path, you know that you have a working backup. So what we do is we can configure a second NIC and start measuring in parallel. And then your test box will be split into test box 1 and test box 1B. Test box 1 is the result from 1 to 2 over the red paths. And test box 1B shows you the measurements from 1 to 2 over the green backup paths. And if you do that, this is just some tests we did, where we actually showed that, yes, the backup path is not behaving as it should. So, yeah, this feature is now available. We have, if you like to use it, you have to configure it by hand. Just provide us with a second IP address, and we'll set it up for you. Next, ongoing activity are bandwidth measurements. Mark showed some results in the September meeting, and then he wrote his master's thesis on it. And we also submitted a paper to a CADA workshop on bandwidth estimation, and a full report of this. Of this workshop will be available shortly at the URL on the screen. The main outcome is that the tools have available to measure bandwidth have improved significantly over the last year. The accuracy is something of the order of 10% on the latest hardware. It's still somewhat depending on hardware. If you have a slow machine or an old NIC, tools are less accurate. Time to do measurements have been reduced. You can now actually do some estimates in a few minutes, which is good. And the code of all the tools has become a lot more stable, meaning that you can measure continuously, do a measurement. You just loop over a bunch of targets and do measurements. So, we've decided to go back to our original plan, start running these tools on some machines, and just measure available bandwidth and capacity on a regular basis. This will need some work to incorporate into the measurement framework. And once we've done that, we really need your feedback to calibrate the results as much as possible. This will take a couple of months, and I also have to warn you in advance that this is all still research. Once you get numbers, take them with a grain of salt. It's research, it's not yet production quality, but it is some. We're clearly moving ahead to getting more reliable results. Another feature we're doing on the test boxes these days is monitoring of DNS. We're now running a tool that monitors DNS performance for A2M routes, 8 ccTLDs, 3 gTLDs. That's now running as beta. We added documentation. We did all the little things that we had on our to-do lists. And if you go to the DNS Mobile Drive Net website, you can actually see the to-do list there, and you see that Daniel changed it yesterday into to-do list. All items are done. So the only thing, well, it's not exactly correct, since we have to work out the SLAs and a few more administrative things, and then start charging the ccTLDs and the gTLDs to actually use this. Then a request from our Swiss colleagues. If you know the test box spaces is shows you exactly the coordinates where they are, and they asked if we could include the altitude of the boxes. Well, GPS does provide it. It's, however, accurate altitude measurements were never a requirement in GPS design. After all, yeah, it doesn't really matter where you start if you drop a bomb. Yes, but I mean, a cruise missile is essentially dropping a bomb, right? You fly somewhere, and when you think you have the coordinates of your target, you go straight down. So, and the exact height where you start at that point doesn't really matter. So the accuracy is limited to about orders of tens of meters, but still, if you look at the list of the boxes and their location, you now see an extra column with the height. And yes, the Swiss can be proud since their boxes are the highest in the world, whatever that's worth. Other question we've got a couple of times was, can the box act as a P6 aware ATP daemon? And the simple answer to that one is yes. It's yesterday morning, that's possible. Just configure, just put a P6 address in your NTP configuration, and you have a native NTP, P6 NTP pair. Okay, that's it from the NCC. So there, like I said, there was one slide coming from the IPF. There's been a discussion about a thing called OAMP, which stands for One-Way Active Measurements Protocol. And the background is a bit that the IETF has set standards on how to measure delays, how to measure losses. But they just specified the metrics. They didn't specify packet formats to be used, control commands, how to set up a measurement between two boxes, and you need some communication synchronization there. All those things were left out. And OAMP is an attempt to fix these things. What you see is that there are three or four implementations of test boxes, and they all have their own homegrown formats. So if you have installed a box from vendor A and somebody else has one from vendor B, they won't interoperate. And OAMP will make that possible. And the nice thing about it is that this will, if this is implemented, it will double or triple the number of measurement targets, especially in North America. There is a project called Surveyor that has, I believe, 40 or 50 sites all across North America. Adding OAMP would make that interoperable with TTM. The downside is that adding this to TTM is a non-trivial amount of work. So before we start doing it, I'd like to get some feedback, either here or on the list or wherever, if people are interested in doing this. So they don't like to add this and then find out that we've replaced something that works now with something that's not that will also work, but is not used by anybody. So I guess I'll take this one to the list. And that brings me to the plans we have. There are a few ongoing activities. A meeting or two ago, we discussed providing summaries. That's something we're working on at the moment. It was based on what Roberto Cacci presented in Barcelona. We're also looking at how the V6 data and the V4 data compares. That's Michael's work. It's a student project expected to be finished by May. Bandwidth is ongoing. CBS server is something that came up at the previous meeting, and yeah, we basically decided that we want to put a CBS server where all the TTM software can just be downloaded. We then discussed it internally in the NCC, found out that the database group was also interested in that, and then the operators became involved, and then it became a project. So this is still going on. It just needs a bit more discussion than just install Linux distribution on a machine you have lying around somewhere. Few things we want to finish, discuss them. OWMP mentions, and finally the thing we plan to do over this year is make the data suitable for presentation to a wider audience. Right now, if you look at the graphs, it's really geared towards techies who can understand the graph. However, there's a lot of interest in data about the internet in a less technical format, by journalists, politicians, things like that. And that's what the IS reports at the NCC will about in this data. We're looking into ways to include TTM data there as well. And somebody is not going to get an answer to his phone call. So yeah, conclusions, I don't have much to add. So, questions? No questions?
I just want to take a moment to reemphasize the fact that that the main purpose of TTM, as far as I understand it, was invented way before I knew about Riot, is to be able to assist operators in their daily work. So I would like to take a moment to ask you to think about how you are going to be able to use this particular service to automate some of the daily chores. And I'm thinking specifically about the way in which the routing information service evolved through time, from a data collection service to a service that now includes MyAS, in which you can actually set some thresholds and receive some mail when thresholds are exceeded. So please think about these things, because I think it's very important and it's going to make the service more useful to you. Anyway, with apologies again to Hank for having missed the cue, I'm going to go now to introduce Jan Pascal. Again, he is a PhD student from the Technical University of Delft, and I'm really pleased that he's going to be talking about a work that relied on TTM as a data source. I have to make one announcement with regards to our agenda today, and that is that one of the Technical University Delft speakers, Matnix Card, is not able to make his presentation today. And what that means is that we're going to get very fortunate, and with the time that we have left, we're going to be able to get a demo for our last speaker within the time of the group. Of course, those of you who do not want to get techno overload, you are free to go and have coffee. So without any further ado, Jan Pascal, please.
Present to you some work we've been doing on network delay tomography, which is a way or a number of ways of using end-to-end delay measurements such as RIPE the traffic project does, and using that huge set of data to get some information about the network and journal delays that you don't measure directly, but you can use a sort of X-ray from different sites and try to see what happens inside. Well, that basically gave away the idea already. Of course, it isn't easy. There are a lot of challenges. I'll discuss that. Then the way we chose to approach it, there are other possibilities, so say a bit of that. Some of the results we've got up to now, some of the reliability of the method, and the tool we're using, and some conclusions. And after, maybe in the break, or if there's space left, we can arrange for a short demo of the tool. So what's the idea? The idea is we have a very nice test traffic project that generates a lot of data, and some of that is directly useful for the network operators to see what is happening between me and somebody else. But then we thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if you could also use the data to look inside the network, because you're not just looking from yourself as an operator to some other places, but everybody is doing that, so you get a lot of cross sections through the mostly European part of the internet that's being measured. So it would be nice to get some more information on the state of the network, and not only for you, but of the network as a whole. Locating probably maybe problem areas which we need to pay attention to, and what also is interesting is that you can get information on networks of people that are not participating in the test traffic project. And there are some very large ISPs that chose not to participate because they think that would give other people information about their own networks. And now the interesting situation arises that they don't get information about your networks, but you do get information about their networks because they don't participate. Of course, there's some challenges. There's a huge amount of data, and basic normal is that you get for between all the test boxes, if you take a snapshot, you get the order of 6,000 connections, so end-to-end measurements, and that makes for a total of about the same order of magnitude, 7,000 separate links that you see in all the trace routes, so of which you would like to know something. More than that, the trace route, as we all know, as a tool, isn't very reliable. A lot of errors, a lot of strange things that happen. When you look at trace routes, there are holes in the measurements, so you don't know what's going on there. There you can also find loops in trace routes, which would seem to be impossible unless you think really hard about how the tool works. So you would have to do a lot of filtering and throw a lot of stuff out before you get a bit of reliable data set. And then, of course, if you get more, if you regard it as a root set of equations, so you have an end-to-end measurement from point A to point B, which more or less said, well, the total end-to-end delay we measure is 50 milliseconds, and we have this link, this link, this link, this link, so 10 links in a row, and the total delay over this set of links is 50 milliseconds. So you can see that as a linear equation. Now, if you do that for all 4,000 end-to-end measurements, and you have 6,000, which is more links, then of course it's not possible to solve all that. But you can do some approximations and some things you can do. So what did we do? First, we looked at all the trace routes and trying to find a more or less stable subset, which means throwing everything out that you don't like, and also throw everything out that doesn't stay the same for at least a couple of instances in a row. So if there are some routing changes in between, of course it can happen inside a trace route, so you can just junk out of it, so you want to get rid of all those. Then you take the minimum measured delay over every path you have, every stable path. During, we chose here one day, because the first idea is to get to take out all the queuing delays and only look at the transmission and some of the processing delays to get a more stable set. If this starts working, then we can go on and look at the queuing delays. The next step you really need to do is identify as well as possible all the separate interfaces that belong to the same routers. We do this here using UDP probe, so we just send UDP packets to all the interfaces we know and look who answers. And if you send it to one interface, you get an answer from another interface, and you know that they belong to the same router, at least that's what you hope. Next step is if you look at all this and you make a huge graph that contains all those trace routes, and you get a graph of I don't know how many nodes and edges. You see there are a lot of strings in there, of chains that are always the same, especially at the end, at the edges of the network. So trace route is connected, a test box is connected to the rest of the network via a number of hops. They're always the same. So it makes sense to just compress those into one segment. And then you can say something about that segment, because you could never get more information from end-to-end measurements about what happens inside those segments, because you don't have any cross measurements inside. And then the main choice we've made is to keep things simple, and we use just a least square technique for calculating link delays from the end-to-end delays. As I said in earlier, have a huge set of linear equations, you just try to get the best approximation for the link or the segment delays that you want to find out. There are other techniques possible. You can use a lot of statistics and find not just one number, but a distribution for the link delays, which is, I just haven't really looked into that, but it's it makes things a lot harder. You just wanted to get some results here to see if it was useful. Let's see, if you do that, this is a more or less a typical sample of the results. Here the nodes are routers, and all the small lines are links between routers, and they are color-coded, in which green is the lowest delay measured, and red is the highest delay measured. So there are just a few of them inside, and they go through from green to black and then to red. This is just too much to see. You can try and find yourself inside there, but it won't work. So I filled it out a bit, and these are the top percent or so of all the delays of the threshold at about 30 milliseconds. So every link in the internet is measured at, I think it was 25th of May last year, that we think has a delay of over 30 milliseconds, is in this list. So you can, if you can read your peer message, you can see if you're in there. And that's supposed to mean that you might have had some trouble last year. And this is the kind of thing that we would think that operators might find useful. Of course, if it's in your own network, then you already know it, or you should know. But these kind of things might also happen in your neighboring networks, or it might happen in your backup path, which you might like to know. If they are having trouble, it might influence your own operations. This is just a histogram. So we see that most of the delays are less than 10 milliseconds. There are a few larger, but there is still a large tail. There are always, whatever large number you think of, there's probably some link somewhere that has that large delay. Then what you would want to know, of course, is are these estimates any good? As we'll see, they're not very good. Because, well, we just don't have enough information to really get the proper numbers. But there are some things you can say for it. And what we try to do here is not using the measured data, but putting in synthetic data. If you just using a random generator, fill in a number for every link, then calculate, just add together for every trace route the end-to-end delay, and then use the whole procedure to find back the link delays and compare them to what you put in. So see if it's more or less consistent to what you originally put in. If that's consistent, it means that the procedure works more or less. So when you do that, this is the graph of the difference from the calculated link delays from the synthesized link delays. And you see that on the left there's a large part smaller than zero, which means that for many links, the calculated link delay is actually a lot smaller than the original link delay, which means that you underestimate the link delays. But there's also a large tail to the right, which means that you overestimate also a lot of link delays. And I should say here that what we put in was just a straight distribution from 10 to 50 milliseconds. So you overestimate some, but not much more than what you originally put, which means this is the same only for very large delays. We're mostly interested in links that have a large delay because of a problem there. And you see that for the ones, I took just the ones over 40 milliseconds. And then there are just most of them you underestimate. There are some you overestimate, but never very much. So, which means more or less that if you find using this procedure that a certain link has a very large delay, it probably really has. For the ones that have a small delay, it's not much you can say. It can just be a coincidence of the algorithm. And that's the answer to the question on the estimates in the group. They are not very good if you're really interested in one single link, what's the delay there. But if you want to find out where are the problems in the network, which are the delays that are have a high delay, then this is a very good get very good estimate. So make a bit of a commercial for the tool we've been developing. Maybe somebody's interested in it's very experimental at the moment, and you can get the graphs out, you can do the calculations. It's not very nice, you have to change things in the program if you want to do things different. But it can do a lot of stuff. It imports data from test traffic, both the infrastructure and the delay measurement, and also from the point routing routing information service data. And you can get AS-level graphs. It does some graph layout. So for the very big graph with thousands of nodes, it makes no sense. You can't layout it anyway. But for smaller graphs, makes a very nice, pleasing picture. Does some trace filtering to keep all the nasty stuff out. You can do the router mapping, do the segmentation. You can also map still in its own way. We haven't used the WISRIP data yet. Map IP numbers to AS numbers to get graphs on the AS level. Delay calculation, just showed you in there. And it can do the histograms and synthetic delays. It's hard to say. We throw out a lot of trace routes, about, I don't know, 90% or so. But you keep most of the source destination pairs. So for every, if you for every, let's say from test box 4 to 90, there are a lot of trace routes in there that are just, you know, they're both. There are holes in there, there are loops in there, other things. They're not stable. So you throw a lot of trace routes you can throw out, but you always, for every pair of test boxes, you get at least one trace route that's stable. This takes a long time, it takes an hour or so. very much memory limited. So if you have more memory, we go a lot faster. So conclusions again. It's not reliable for general LinkedIn information. If you really want to know for this link somewhere in the internet how fast is it, you're not going to get an answer. You're going to get an answer that you know it's not right. If you want to know where are the where are things very slow, then you will get an answer and it will probably be right. There are still, of course, the limitations of using traceroute. So if you're using MPLS in networks, you can just see through the model what's happening. And there are some ideas we have for future work. First, of course, we want to compare the results to real data. So ask operators if they have some delay data or some of the links and see if what they find comes out of here also. Another idea is using larger data sets. If you have more path through the network, then you can make better estimations, you have more cross-section, which gives more information. And you might try our hand at other methods, maybe using some statistical methods, that gives not one number for delay at a certain link, but gives it a distribution, or at the moment, using, if you have the current amount of data at that link, so what's the distribution of the time you have to wait, including all the congestion that maybe happened. And if people are interested, I can give a demo of the software later in the break or whenever. Any comments, questions? No, because there's a lot of statistical noise in there, and also because you have, it's a linear system which you have more knowns than you have equations, so you know there's uncertainty in the answers, and the algorithm just finds one point that fits the data, but you don't know what's really happening, so it can't fit to the reality if it doesn't know anything. Just fits to whatever it knows. But for that, you're guessing.
Thank you.
next speaker is from the Free University of Amsterdam. He is also a PhD student. His name is Michal Szymanowski. And his work is somewhat related to Jan Pascal's concerns and ideas, but he has a different angle on it. And we agreed prior to him coming here that because of the cancellation of the third talk, he was going to give a little demo of his work in the context of the working group. So with this, we'll give the microphone to him. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. My name is Michał Szymaniak, and I am, as was said, a PhD student at the Free University of Amsterdam. And I will tell you about a research project my group has been working on, which is called SCO, which stands for Scalable Cooperative Latency Estimation. And this project was, among the others, based on the data collected by the TTM infrastructure. And I would also like to thank both Hank and Alex for giving me this opportunity to present this work here to this audience. Okay, so in our research we deal with large-scale distributed systems which may contain millions of nodes scattered over the internet. The specific problem we are investigating right now is latency estimation. So basically we are trying to find an efficient way of discovering a delay between any two machines provided there are millions of them. Of course, as long as you have a small system, even like 100 of TTM test boxes, it's quite easy. You just ping each other, you have these delays, and that's it, you are done. However, if there are millions of nodes, it is no longer obvious how to do it right. An interesting solution to this problem is called network positioning, global network positioning, GNP. GNP models the internet as an n-dimensional geometric space and assigns each machine a position in this space. And then, once all the positions are known, GNP estimates the latency between any two nodes as the Euclidean distance between their corresponding positions. The main benefit from using GNP is reduced number of measurements that need to be performed in order to get all the estimates. Instead of measure these m square latencies when there are m machines in the system, with a naive approach when everybody thinks everybody, we only need a linear number of measurements because that's how much GNP needs to position all the nodes. And in my talk, I will first introduce you to GNP. I will discuss its performance and its limitations. Then I will show how these limitations are solved in our system called SCO. I will say a few words about the SCO architecture, and I will describe our experience with deploying SCO in the real-world environment. In the end, I will propose certain projects which you may find useful as internet service providers. Okay, so let's first see how GNP estimates latencies. The first step is to construct this n-dimensional space, because that's where we are going to position all these machines we have. Each n-dimensional space is determined by n plus 1 reference nodes called landmarks. So the first step is to select these landmarks. Then the second step is to measure latencies between each pair of landmarks. And finally, based on this clique of latencies, we assign coordinates to each of the one coordinate, of course, one position to each landmark, such that for each pair of landmarks, the distance between the landmark's positions is as close as possible to its corresponding measured real-world latency. And in practice, we use an algorithm that minimizes global error between these distances, between landmarks, and their corresponding latencies. So, for example, if we construct a two-dimensional space, we have to choose two landmarks, we have to measure three latencies, And then based on these latencies, we have to assign three positions in two-dimensional space, one per each landmark. After all the landmarks have been positioned, we can position any other node related to the landmarks. And it happens very similarly to what was going on in the space construction phase. Basically, given this new node we want to position, we just measure three latencies, one per each landmark we are going to position this node related to. And based on these three latencies, we assign or calculate, the node position such that, again, these distances between new node position and each of the landmark position is as close as possible to its corresponding latency. So again, in our two-dimensional space, we only need to measure three latencies, and based on these three latencies, we position on our node in a two-dimensional space related to the set of landmarks. Well, as for cost of DNP, the first thing to point out is that this space dimension doesn't need to be really large in order to achieve good estimation accuracy. We have discovered that for practical applicability, it's perfectly enough if you use a space dimension of 6, which is not really too high. Then the second thing is that because we need a fixed number of measurements to construct n-dimensional space based on a given set of landmarks, and another fixed number of measurements to position a single node, we only need a linear number of measurements to position all the nodes in a given system. And once we have these positions, a single latency estimation doesn't require any measurements because it's simply a calculation between two positions in some geometric space. As for performance, in turn, in 90% of cases, the latency estimates GNP provides are off by less than 50%, which means that latency estimates provided by GNP are within three-thirds, or between two-thirds and three-halves of the real latency observed between two given nodes. And you can see this in this graph showing cumulative error distribution for latency estimates, where this 90% of cases fall within the interval delimited by -5 and +5. However, GNP also has some limitations. Most important one is that all these nodes in our system, so potentially millions of nodes, must be positioned related to the same set of landmarks. So either these landmarks are globally fixed or globally negotiated, and none of these two solutions scales well up to millions of nodes. The thing is that the same set of landmarks seldom suits all the nodes with respect to the requirements. For example, if you have millions of nodes and they are not necessarily, for example, part of this same company network, but they are scattered over the world, so belong to different people having different preferences, each of these nodes can have different requirements with respect to estimation accuracy. Each can trust different nodes in the world, and many other things as well. So the thing is that both of these problems can be solved if only each host in our system is allowed to choose its own landmarks. But of course, if we use different landmarks, then we have different spaces, and different spaces mean different positions. If we use different spaces, we cannot talk about global positions anymore. But the thing is that what we are looking for are latencies, not the positions. We only have to treat the positions as a form of intermediate data, which is in the end used for latency estimation. And if we accept this assumption, we can do one nice trick, which we did in SCOLE. SCOLE is a personalized version of GNP, which means that every node in SCOLE runs its own instance of GNP. Basically, it means that each SCOLE node selects its own landmarks according to its own preferences, and then positions any other nodes it prefers, for example, its clients or peers or whatever, according to its own, related to its own landmarks. As a consequence, there is no longer global negotiation or global fixed landmarks, and estimation can be adjusted on a per-node basis to whichever a given host given node needs. Of course, as I said, different landmarks mean different spaces and consequently different positions, which will be, of course, different if they are calculated by different nodes. But the thing is that if one host consistently uses the same set of landmarks and positions other nodes related to the same set of landmarks, it can derive latency estimates from its own GNP instance. And the best part is that whichever landmark set we use, the latency estimates made by different hosts, so potentially using different set of landmarks, these latency estimates will be globally correlated. You can observe it in this graph showing the correlation between latencies estimated by two hosts, each using a completely different set of landmarks. The x-axis means the latency estimated by some host A, the y-axis means latency estimated by some host B, and as you can see, most of the dots, and each dot means a single latency estimation between a given pair of nodes, most of the dots are really close to the diagonal, which means perfect match, which means that both hosts estimate exactly the same value of latency between two given hosts. So effectively, SCO is an extension to GNP, which removes this requirement for global landmarks, which is good for scalability, but at the same time, it ensures that the latency estimates made by different hosts are globally correlated, which is desirable for practical applications. Oops. Okay. Here it is. So here is SCO architecture, fortunately. And as we remember, each SCO node chooses its own landmarks. We can see them as this white circles. The SCO node is a black circle. And this SCO node can position any host H relative to its own landmarks. So for example, SCO node may decide to position this host because there was some application level data exchange between these two. And whenever it happens, whenever the decision is taken to position the host H, latency measurements must be performed between the host and each of the landmarks. Then the landmarks must report this latencies back to the SCO node, which based on these latencies can discover host H position, and based on this position, estimate latencies between this host and any other hosts that were positioned previously. Two things important at this point is that first, landmarks must be physically distributed over the internet, which is important for estimation accuracy. Basically, if you put all the landmarks in one rack case, it will not work. So preferably, you have to have your landmarks wherever your clients are, more or less. Second thing is that landmarks must be able to measure latencies to each other, simply because the SCO node will need these latencies in order to create its own geometric space, as remember from the GNP description a couple of slides ago. And now if we become practical, and wait for a while, there will be, or not, okay, here's the plan, hopefully. Is it so slow? Okay. Weird. Anyway, if we deploy this architecture in a real-world environment, you can imagine, for example, a CDN, content delivery network, using SCO to redirect its clients. So, for example, imagine you have a CDN with all these web servers scattered all over the world, which wants to redirect its clients to their proximal web servers based on the latency between clients and the servers. So, if we treat now each web server that we have in as a separate SCO node, and the host we position our clients or other web servers, then what happens is, when a client first comes to one of our web servers, it sends some HTTP request. It can be given, apart from a regular HTML code, it can also be given inside this HTML document a list of hidden HTML references pointing at different objects located at different web servers in the CDN. Now imagine that this web server runs this, runs a GNP instance as a part of a scroll operation, such that the web servers are its landmarks. So because it has all these web servers all around the world, it has chosen some landmarks to chosen some web servers to be its landmarks. So back to the web client, whenever it sees this HTML document, it follows all the references inside. So it in particular, it will follow all these hidden references we have provided. And it will contact all the web servers, all the landmarks, in fact. And if we ensure that these web servers can passively measure latencies to the client, then we have suddenly performed latency measurement without client noticing it. When these latency measurements, when the result of these measurements are reported back to the original web server, the web server can position the client and redirect this client to any web server it finds the best for this client, basically because it already knows the position of other web servers. Another purpose of running scroll, apart from redirection, which is quite obvious, is, for example, placement. We have run a scroll for 1 month on our university website using PlanetLab nodes as landmarks. PlanetLab is a global infrastructure of Linux boxes contributed by different research institutions. And in this graph, you can see roughly 5,000 of clients which happened to contact our university website through this 1 month. And after they have been positioned in a two-dimensional space, you can see that, well, there are some points where number of clients is really high, or they are really dense, because each colorful dot means one unique client IP address. So these dense points are probably good places for your mirrors or replicas or whatever you want to place to provide your clients with. And just to make sure that these positions are not completely useless, we have mapped all these client IP addresses to the respective continents of origin. So we have different colors, meaning different continents. For example, red one is Europe, green one is North America, light blue is Australia, dark blue is South America, and green, yellow one is Asia. And as it turns out, clients coming from the same continent are co-located in this picture and in this space which it represents. And keep in mind that this picture alone is a two-dimensional representation of all your clients. So basically, because we need to run it in six dimensions for good accuracy, this one is not even too accurate. And even with this low accuracy, you already have a high clustering of your clients. So just imagine what happens in 6D, and I will not show it to you because 6D is quite difficult to present in this thing. And you can see, for example, that there are also some problems. For example, in Europe, you have some hosts from Australia, some hosts from America, Asia, and so on and so on, and it's not as good as it could be if you just take this picture and try to advertise scroll. But in fact, if you take these mislocated dots and try to follow what they mean exactly, it turns out that it is not scroll that was wrong here. It is, well, the mapping procedure. Basically, because what we did for to map all these clients were first determine the AS they belong to, and then take the headquarters of company owning this AS. Now, as you can imagine, if you have global backbone with headquarters in America, it will mean that all the nodes falling into this global AS will belong to America, according to our mapping scheme. Well, they will, but if they happen to be located in Europe, then they will be in Europe. And so happens that, for example, Novell branch of Australia, in Australia, happens to have a what they call teleport, satellite uplink to Europe, and that's how it's located in Europe. And other things like American providers is UUNet or AT&T Global Services, and they are also in Europe, even though they are basically European endpoints of global backbones. So basically, it all shows that you don't have to believe, and honestly, I didn't believe it until half a year ago, But when I saw this picture and when I tried to investigate all these little errors, I really started to believe. Well, it's not matrix, yeah. Okay, so what is all of this has to do with TTM? And it's high time, I guess, to propose this project, I promised. Well, what we propose is to turn TTM test boxes into landmarks so that anybody can run its own Scala instance, anybody, I mean, any participating ISP. And why TTM test boxes are perfect candidates for landmarks? Well, first of all, because they measure latencies to each other anyway as part of normal TTM operation, so they can also measure other latencies upon request. But more importantly, they are physically distributed, which means that these latency measurements can cross ISP boundaries, and using test boxes as landmarks gives you, puts you in perfect situation, because even if you cannot afford a global infrastructure of landmarks, you can take test boxes and use them as such. And benefits, of course, from this project would be that you have suddenly latency estimation between any pair of internet hosts that contact you. So, for example, you can integrate Scala as a latency estimation service, standalone service, or integrate it with any operations, any services you provide, such as, I don't know, CDNs or anything else. And such a service, as we've seen, can be useful for client redirection, pickup placement, and probably for many other things as well. So the conclusion is that, as you have seen, network positioning technique allows for scalable latency estimation. It doesn't require too many measurements in order to estimate latencies. It offers reasonable accuracy. It can be personalized, so we migrate from GNP to Scala, so that everybody can adjust GNP setting to its own needs. And at the same time, even though we personalize settings, we don't lose the possibility of estimating highly correlated latencies in many independent locations. And given all this stuff, the biggest question is whether you as the right people would like to have such a service to use. Well, thank you very much. Well, in fact, everything you have to do is to adjust your landmark location. Basically, this accuracy of GNP will never be perfect, of course, because it's still estimation and not real measurement. But it highly depends on how you choose your landmarks. So if the landmarks are well placed, you will have better. It will not be perfect, never. Okay, I gave you a hint that landmarks must be physically distributed over the internet, and yeah, of course, preferably, they also have to be placed among your clients, because not every web server has the same community of clients, of course. But the truth is that about how to position your landmarks, there are at least four different papers, each suggesting slightly different strategies, and I would say it's still the matter of research how to do it right. Yes. Well, our ambition is not to put Akamai out of business yet, but at the university we are working on the CDN, which takes a slightly different approach than what is followed now. Namely, right now CDNs are big companies renting all these machines in different data centers. And what we propose is that CDNs can also be formed as peer-to-peer networks when different people contribute their machines. These machines get together, form a content delivery network, sharing disk space, sharing different resources. And given a number of machines joined in this kind of network, you can run basically a simple CDN where every node is in charge of its own documents, but it may also use the disk space at other nodes, contributed by other nodes, to replicate itself. According to, for example, measuring this this client community, so finding the best location for its replicas and so on and so on. So it is it's called target group. The target group is in this case are people who cannot afford Akamai services because it's too expensive. So exactly what happens is that you can get together and you can build your own CDN which will operate like open source thing. And it is open source, in fact, and you can download it right now. Maybe not a competition to Akamai, because it will not be good, as good as Akamai for a long time, but at least it will be free, and we will offer similar services. Thank you. What I said was that web servers are passively measuring the latencies to the clients. So basically what you need is to have any two packets going there and back. Try to imagine what happens if you download something from HTTP, via HTTP. You first open TCP connection, you send HTTP request, it comes back, and that's it. Assuming this simple model. But what happens during the TCP handshake, you send SYN, you get SYNACK. Then you have two packets. Between SYNACK and ACK, a server, based on this delay, can see what was the round trip time to its client. And that's it. Client doesn't know anything, server is happy to have this latency, and that's what it reports back to the SCON node. That simple. Yeah. Landmarks, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the highest problem, probably. Honestly, we don't know. These HTTP transactions don't need to be very large. For example, you can just serve one pixel transparent GIFs, and that's it. So it will not be more than maybe 6 packets for one transaction. But anyway, it will be some more than generated by TTM itself, especially if you try to integrate SCO with some highly popular website. But yeah, that's a part of, well, you may say it's a cost of running this infrastructure.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That was my impression, that you're going to give a demo. That's, I mean, maybe mistaken, but it's not a big deal. So, do we have any other questions, items, nothing? Then I declare the session closed, and I'll see you tomorrow at 11.
Bye. That's what I thought.
Okay, then how about we have a demo from Jan Pascal instead? Anybody who wants to stay? Thank you.
this wasn't really prepared, so it's not working the way I would like it to. I'm just opening a large data set. Normally you would either get it from a database server where all the data we have mirrored locally. And in this case, once you process it and make snapshot and everything, you can put it in a local file and open it. That's what I did here. My menu was gone. Come back. This place seems to hate me. Yeah. All I have here is a small blue rectangle, so I'm not quite sure what's happening. This is called the demonstration effect. Yeah, it's also called Java, yeah. It's also called not programming very nicely and just using a lot of objects to represent the graph. Which usually works out unless you're giving a demo. Let's skip this one. Great. What's this? Okay. Let's start somewhere else. We'll just we get a data set from the database. We have used the same SQL setup as the RIPE database users, only we've added also the end-to-end delays into the same SQL database and normally in root files, just to make querying easier. We have a start date. I have the delays of only a couple of days in the database. So we just take 1 hour from this day, and then to make things go quicker, I can't really see what I'm doing. Just select not all, but a couple of the test boxes. Don't know which ones are wrong this time. These those are always on. And those got just directly the delays between them. And for fun, take a snapshot every 10 minutes, so we get then 6 snapshots for this period. Selecting the trace routes and reading them now at the selected points in time and also delay measurements at the same time. And finished, we can see it. Just have to get it here. Let's see. No, not here. Anybody have any experience with these horrible machines? This one should be the primary display.
Can't use this switch.
Okay. You got us.
That's weird.
Yeah, that was my problem. it should say somewhere. Maybe it will not work. No, it's just very intelligent. I think it has two displays at the same time. This one's still running. Okay. It's not very interesting. This is just the test box is local at RIPCC. Lay out them, at least you can do by hand. If they're very large, you can't do it at all. And let's add some labels there. These are the IP addresses or the node names, but they also have some more information on the autonomous system that the IP address belongs to. And if you do segmentation, so you summarize this whole thing into one link, you can also, if you click on the link, and that's not very interesting, you get a list of the IP numbers in the segment. Well, we see what they can do here. I think it's not very interesting. Convert this to an AS graph, you get a single node, so that's also not very interesting. You can try and see what we can calculate here. It's finished already. It is a very small network, so I won't show too much. Let's color those edges. So this is how they're all about the same. It's all less than milliseconds, so I can't really show that. Of this you could get the histograms I showed in the presentation. You can do some filtering. If I get another one, let's see. One that is not as big as the other one. Open the big one we had earlier. And then I can convert.
converted to an autonomous system level graph. So you summarize all the IP addresses that belong to one autonomous system into one node, so you get a much simpler graph. And you can work with that. That's because it's an old version file, so there's a lot of errors. It doesn't mean anything. And it's very handy, so now you can see it doing stuff. These are just the RFC 1918 addresses and the loops and other numbers. And should do it. Gives the names of the autonomous systems as labels next to the nodes. And well, it's also we do this to look at who is connected to whom according to the test boxes and the traceroutes between them. And what we could do is, it's very useful. Of course, the end-to-end delay measurements also apply to this graph. So you could do the same delay calculations. But it won't take into account any delays internal to an autonomous system, so we'll just assume that everything inside an AS goes by speed of light and the rest takes all the time, so it's, the results are not very, very realistic. Let's see. Used here is a kind of simulated annealing, so similar to the way in physics, if you have a metal, you want to have a very nice lattice structure. You cool it down very slowly to get all the atoms getting to a nice position. It's the same, more or less, you do here. Where you define an energy function. It gets the contributions if edges cross or think are too close together, or if edges get too long. Try to get the energy of the total system as low as possible, which should mean a nice, more or less nice graph, as nice as possible for these kind of graphs. Well, you can just stop it now. We're not quite sure what it is now, but we can at least put it back there with this. Not yet. I just heard it was available since yesterday. Actually, it just queries who is on the fly to ask for the. That's the opportunity. Okay. it's the same stuff. You can just click on the node and then you get some information about the autonomous system that is represented there. And what you can also do is you can turn on a date filter. And because these measurements were taken at some intervals, you can see which links and which nodes were available or measured at that time. And of course, it doesn't really have to mean that the link was down at the time, because it just be that the trace route wasn't measured because somewhere else it was down, the test box was down. It still gives an idea of which things. Something else. It's still dates, but you can see when the relay that's used here was actually used. Another kind of measurement, you do snapshots every hour, every day, or every week. They compare those over time. It's off again. Loath to try the VLOW calculation, it normally takes a lot of time. If the graph is smaller, but it still takes a lot of time. It's not very interesting. There's some help that really doesn't help much. Well, let's try it anyway.
If anything you'd like me to show.